Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, a radio show that's an all-out struggle for truth. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, bringing you the best guests I can find, bringing you alternative information way outside the corporate-controlled mainstream box, about as far outside as I can find sometimes. Today, going back to a very interesting topic, which is sort of the personality issues and the disinformation issues and the controversies on the left, the pro-Palestine left, the 9/11 truth left. There are all sorts of interesting little splits and disputes going on. And one of the most interesting is, what is the role of Max Blumenthal? Max Blumenthal is the son of Sidney Blumenthal, a player, a major liberal Zionist player, a close advisor to Hillary Clinton. The emails exchanged between those two are a quite interesting read. Max Blumenthal, the son of Sidney, is this new generation anti-Zionist Jew. Well, is he really anti-Zionist, or is he just, like, admitting that the Palestinians are human and maybe shouldn't be abused so badly? In any case, Max Blumenthal is a welcome, refreshing voice of compassion for Palestinians. But there are some issues around Max Blumenthal, who seems to think that he can set discursive red lines saying, don't cross that red line or talk about 9/11 truth, or don't be a Gilad Atzmon and talk about Jewish identity politics, or you are an evil racist and must be shouted down, shunned, and banned from every important forum, and you'll never work in this town again. That seems to be his style. And Gilad Atzmon has spoken out about this, and so has my guest today, Greg McCarron, did I get that right?
Yes, sir, you got it.
Greg McCarron, all right. I just met Greg McCarron here in Kansas City area, and Greg has this great piece out that I read before I met him and even really knew who he was on Max Blumenthal absolving Abby Martin of 9/11 trutherism. He says that Abby is not guilty of being a 9/11 truther because she only did this back when she was young and crazy, and she's outgrown that. That sounds like BS to me. What do you think, Greg?
Well, I totally agree with you. And what happened was, I'll give a little brief synopsis of the most recent exchange that led to this. There was a writer for the New York Times. His name is Robert Mackey, and this is in 2014, shortly after there was a big controversy where Abby Martin got some mainstream media attention for her comments about the Russia-Crimea conflict on her RT program. And anyway, you had James Kirchick, who's this neoconservative Zionist warmonger, called on Lawrence O'Donnell's show on MSNBC and called Abby Martin a nutcase and a lunatic and said that she spreads 9/11 truth theories and that she thinks that, you know, fluoride is going to, you know, people are going to die from drinking fluoride and all this, and really exaggerated her views. So anyways, Robert Mackey in the New York Times was part of this, what I call a smear campaign against her. He posted in the New York Times a video from her of 2008 at a 9/11 truth rally in San Diego where she asserts that 9/11 was an inside job, and she says that she knows it was because she studied the matter for years, and there's no way that these towers fell the way that the government and the official 9/11 commission report says they fell. And she also questioned the what happened at the Pentagon as well. And so anyway, Robert Mackey picked up on this, and he's posts about the New York Times. Now, fast forward 2.5 years later, he's writing for The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald's outlet. And I guess Robert Mackey went on a it was brought up to Abby Martin some things that Robert Mackey had said. And, you know, she went on about how he's a shill and a rightly, you know, he's a propagandist. And so he started criticizing her for her 9/11 views again in a post. And then Max Blumenthal jumps in, the aforementioned son of Sidney Blumenthal, complicit in the destruction of Libya. He jumps in and says, well, you know, this is these are unfair tactics you're using, and she expressed these views on her RT program and the views you're talking about, and you're leading, he called it McCarthyite witch hunt. And so, you know, Robert Mackey gets back into it and says, you know, these views are unacceptable for good journalists and all this. And Max says, well, but she hasn't expressed them recently. You're attacking her for her political views. He posted a 2014, I believe it was, 9/11 oriented episode of her RT program, Breaking the Set, which mainly dealt with hijackers and Saudis and unanswered questions about the
money trail to the hijackers, yes, exactly. Implicating the Saudi royals. Yes, but, well, nothing about demolition, nothing about Cheney and Rumsfeld, nothing about Israel, none of the high perpetrators ever even mentioned.
Which is interesting. She actually, in her early days on her RT program, before the whole Ukraine thing, she kind of treaded lightly, but she actually did get into some of those matters previously, mm-hmm. bringing people like Kevin Ryan on her program. But then she more and more softened her stance on it as time went on. And by this point, it was, yes, it was complete, completely focused on hijackers and Saudis and all this. So Max posted that, and he, I quote, "I defy you to find a trace of trutherism." And so Mackie keeps on going on, and Mackie posts the 2008 video of her at the 9/11 Truth Rally. And Max says, well, that's years ago. You're posting views that she probably does not stand by today anymore. And so I picked on to this because I've been following this situation closely for a couple of years, and I wrote an article about it. It was posted on the 9/11 blogger website. Brandon Martinez posted it on his blog.
And, you know, this is the most recent thing I've read on bloggers. It's the only thing I've read on 9/11 blogger in a long time. And it, you know, I was pleasantly surprised. And then I was even more pleasantly surprised to meet the guy who wrote it. And I had no idea that you were here in this area.
It's very humbling. So I posted the article, and I feel it's a very important article, and I think it's more than just 9/11 truth. I feel that, and we can get a little more into Max Blumenthal's past and his some of the things he's done as we go on in the conversation. But to allow a guy like him to set parameters on what is and is not acceptable, and that's exactly what he's mm-hmm. doing in this case, mm-hmm. I think it has huge implications for truth-telling pursuits.
Yeah, and you know, it'd be one thing if he was defending her by saying, well, she said these things a while back, and, you know, maybe she hasn't talked about it so much, but really, what's the point? I mean, isn't she allowed to have her views? How are we going to filter out the whole discursive space to make sure that nobody who questions any of these things ever gets a voice? Right. That would be a legitimate way of, you know, even just modifying the way he said it. You know, there are ways that he could have said it in a way that would be acceptable. With this, it really looks like he thinks he's some kind of thought policeman.
Exactly.
Who is, you know, and he agrees that anybody who's really talking about 9/11 outside of certain parameters deserves to be condemned, but it's just that she doesn't, right?
Right, and that's exactly, it's funny, it's exactly the role he plays, and there have been numerous examples of him doing this over the years. In fact, he's attacked Cynthia McKinney for being a 9/11 truther. He's actually, because he was criticizing her for what he called being an apologist for Gaddafi during the time of the NATO, Hillary Clinton-led war on Libya.
Well, his dad was making zillions on the destruction of Libya.
Well, he tried to cash in, one of the things within this email scandal is the fact that Cindy Blumenthal was giving her classified information about this situation on the ground in Libya, working with General David Grange, actually. They were hoping to profit financially from the regime change in Libya. I don't know if it actually worked out for him that he did, but, I mean, he very much was complicit in the destruction of Libya. And while this is going on, Max Blumenthal is criticizing Cynthia McKinney for her stance on Libya. And he also had a Twitter post where he says that Cynthia McKinney surrounds herself with 9/11 truthers. So it's interesting that Max is openly defending someone who at one point was such an avowed and vocal proponent and promoter of 9/11 truth. And now he's basically saying she's not guilty of this. And he's, instead of the way that you described it, saying, you know, she has a right to her views, he's almost saying that, like, she does not stand with these people anymore, and therefore she's welcomed in our circles because she doesn't stand with these people anymore. That's the way I saw his commentary and the way I saw his reaction to Robert Mackey's criticism of
her. And he seems to be very prickly about a number of things, 9/11 truth being one of them. He doesn't approve of people who cross the line in ways that, for instance, Gilad Atzmon has.
Yes.
I've seen, you know, Gilad's discussion of Max Blumenthal, which is pretty acerbic. I think Gilad discusses, you know, Max attacking him in the bathroom somewhere at a conference, or, you know, they had a big fight, this sort of thing. But it seems like Blumenthal has appointed himself to say these thoughts are so evil and outside the mainstream that these people have to be banned and banished. And this, you know, Gilad says this is a kind of traditional mentality that was in, you know, very common in the Jewish ghettos, where people had to hang together, and if you were sort of outside the norm, or, you know, if what you were saying was considered some kind of threat to the community or to this aspect of the community, then you would be banished. There's a lot of that. So Gilad puts that in that cultural context. Mm-hmm. But I think with Max Blumenthal, mm-hmm. essentially he's breaking new ground by being relatively pro-Palestinian for a very well-connected Jewish Zionist guy.
Yeah.
And so maybe he's sensitive about, like, well, how far can one go, you know, being outrageous? How much new ground can be broken? And then he's, you know, being, you know, saying, okay, these people are outside the bounds, they're beyond the pale, as it were.
I agree very much. And it's funny when you listen, not just Max Blumenthal, but the soft Zionist progressive left. They're the ones that are vocally outspoken about Israel's criminality and policies. And by the way, with regards to the whole Zionism thing, I think that's really picked up over the years, whereas in the 80s, you look at the left, you know, what you call maybe the Jewish left, they were all fixated on South Africa and apartheid. There was very little conversation about Israel. Although I think there was always some criticism of Zionism in there. It's gone back kind of to Israel's founding. You can find debates about Zionism within the Jewish community. But now it's over the last, I'd say, probably, especially since the rise of the internet, I think that there's become a very vocal Jewish pro-Palestinian community. And I think in large part a lot of that is because, and I'm not going to make a blanket statement and say that all of these people are like somehow, you know, working on behalf of Zionism. That would be unfair to say. But I think that there is this mentalities, this idea is with the internet that not everything can be suppressed. And the basic facts of Israel's criminality towards the Palestinians can no longer be suppressed from like the entire, especially from the progressive left. They cannot be suppressed. So I think there are people in place, and I think maybe Max Blumenthal plays this role, and people within organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace play this role of being the conscientious Jewish voice to oppose the destruction in Palestine. But they're also in many ways serving as a function of like a gatekeeping function to, by promoting themselves out there first and foremost being Jewish and being opposed to what's going on, they are playing the role of controlling the narrative and keeping people from going too far. And when you read their attacks on people like Ken O'Keefe or Alison Weir, you read what they write about these people, it almost reads like an ADL or an SPLC press release.
Mm-hmm. And this guilt by association thing that they do is often very much mixed up in this. It's as if they're really trying to make sure that there isn't unity between sort of the more mainstream and the less educated people and the people who are much more sort of committed and maybe knowledgeable about certain kinds of crimes. With Alison Weir, it seems like she was targeted because she went to this place that's actually very dangerous for Zionism, mm-hmm. which is really getting at the way that the Zionists have hijacked the American system.
Yes.
And this is a very, very sensitive topic for a lot of left-wing sort of pro-Palestine Zionists who function as gatekeepers. I encountered this in the late 1990s in Madison, Wisconsin, where certain individuals, such as a Mr. Alan Ruff, I'll go ahead and name some names, who insinuated himself into the key sort of leftist groups in Madison, the bookstore, the radio station. He always got himself into an important position and into the pro-Palestine movement, and then basically acted as a gatekeeper within the pro-Palestine movement to try to prevent the pro-Palestine people from actually building an effective political movement. And to be effective, I argued at the time, they needed to reach out to the broad majority of Americans who are mostly concerned with American interests, American patriotism, American values, and frame the argument that way and point out that the United States has been hijacked by a hostile foreign power. And oh man, did I get shouted down as an evil anti-Semite for making that argument. Yeah. And I think that the reason that you get shouted down for saying these things, and even people like Noam Chomsky will jump on you for talking this way. Chomsky denies that there's any real Zionist power configuration mm-hmm. in the United States, which is complete nonsense. Yeah. And so why are there all these people preaching this absurd nonsense and trying to lead the Palestinians away from a effective political strategy? I think it's precisely that they don't want the Palestinians to adopt an effective strategy, because if the Palestinians win, the Zionists lose, and these people are still basically committed to Zionism.
Oh, I could not agree more. Absolutely. I think that, yeah, and it's, as you said, we said before, it's become more and more infiltrated over the years as the awareness of what's going on, the plight of the Palestinians, is becoming more and more known to the people of the world. In terms of what – that is absolutely the case.
Yeah, so with Alison Weir, she also is willing to go negative against Zionists and point out that, you know, as Zionists are constantly defending themselves and, you know, and basically condoning their own aggression against the Palestinians by saying, oh, we're the victims, we're the eternal victims. Throughout all of history, the Jewish people have always been the victims everywhere they went, and right was always on their side, and the people against them who were in conflict with them were always persecuting them, because they've always been this persecuted and victimized minority. That's the narrative And when Alison Weir comes along and says, well, not always. Here's some examples in history where, well, they actually poisoned Palestinian wells, so you can't call that a blood libel because these Zionists really did poison wells.
Sure.
And, and basically violating the narrative in all of these ways, you know, saying these people are very powerful, they're not victims. They seized power in the United States and have turned U.S. policy against American interests. All of this kind of truth-telling that has an effective political content that could change policy and actually help liberate Palestine. That's what's so dangerous. So that's, in my opinion, that would explain why someone like Max Blumenthal, who may be suspected of not genuinely wishing for the liberation of Palestine, at least the complete liberation of Palestine, might join in these witch hunts against people who are promoting truth that has a powerful political effect, like 9/11 truth.
Yes.
9/11 truth, if and when it goes off to the point that the mainstream has to accept it, it's going to be the biggest political bombshell
Absolutely.
In all of human history.
Absolutely.
And so the people who don't want it to come out because they're afraid of the effects of that bombshell are going to do everything they can to marginalize the 9/11 truth. And there's Blumenthal again and the people like him doing that. So they sure look like what they're trying to accomplish is to prevent the political movements that they say they're working with from ever achieving anything.
Absolutely. And going back to Alison Weir, you mentioned that. And Alison Weir, you can never find, and there are some people that you can find, there are some people who you could legitimately make the case, whether it's fair or not, that you could say they are so-called anti-Semite or anti-Jewish, whatever. You know, you can look at some people's writings.
She isn't.
Absolutely not. I mean, you cannot find one trace of her, like, bad-mouthing somebody for their ethnicity or using their ethnicity against them. No, I've never seen that in all of her years writing. Even the people that are coming out with this attack against her, they can't point to any examples. I think with what happened with I think with Alison Weir's specific case of where she kind of earned the wrath of some of these people was that she wrote a book a couple years ago called Against Our Better Judgment. It goes into the founding of Israel and the U.S. role in it. And she gets into this secret society called the Purusha, made up of influential Jewish Zionists in the United States at the time of World War I, when the U.S. really got involved in World War I, and there was some involvement with the British and these promises made to Palestine that they'd set up a Jewish state in Palestine if, you know, the U.S. came in the side of the war on behalf of the British and the Allies and helped win the war. And Alison got into this, and she named prominent Jewish Zionists like Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish Supreme Court justice. I think this really ruffled some feathers within the Jewish progressive community. It probably hit some of these people close to home who have familial and ancestral connections to these people who are involved in these organizations and groups. And I think that's where the attack against her came from. But with Alison Weir, where she really – where they the specific example they used against Alison Weir was the fact that she did a couple of radio shows with a man named Clay Douglas who had a program on the American Free Press program. I've never listened to any of this stuff, so I can't really say what he's all about. But they described him as being a neo-Nazi and a white nationalist and a white supremacist and all this. And I guess their reason for their indictment against her or her crime was not going out of her way to condemn everything that he said, condemn all of his viewpoints. Like, she was supposed to use his program as a soapbox to lecture him about his
That's pretty bizarre. Like, when I was interviewed by the New York Times, I don't remember that anybody in the 9/11 Truth Movement would say, well, Kevin, you did a terrible thing by going and talking to the New York Times, and you didn't spend the entire time in the interview telling them why the New York Times is so wrong and so evil. Well, look, okay, it's true. I do think the New York Times is absolutely wrong and absolutely evil about a long list of things. But when they came to interview me about my 9/11 case at the University of Wisconsin, I didn't spend the whole interview bashing them. I just talked about whatever the subject was. And there's a weird double standard.
Exactly.
You're not allowed to go on a Clay Douglas show and talk about the subject matter.
Or a show like yours.
Yeah.
Ask a Jammu Baraka. You're not allowed
to
go on a show.
Yeah, Jammu Baraka comes on my show, and that's held against him. There's a guilt by association thing that is it's designed to try to preserve the mainstream hegemonic discourse so that power can continue to have power over our minds.
Well, it's funny that Alison Weir goes on this obscure radio show that very few people have heard of.
I was actually on his show. I think about years ago.
But, I mean, in general, the general population, how many people know who Clay Douglas is? But just 2 days after the Benghazi attacks, Max Blumenthal can write an editorial in The Guardian, one of the most influential newspapers in the world, been very complicit in the destruction of the Middle East as far as being a liberal, like, left-wing probably the foremost, from a global perspective, probably the foremost, along with the New York Times, liberal outlet pushing the imperialist agenda.
Yeah, they're the liberal voice of MI6, according to people I've talked to in the intelligence community.
As opposed to New York Times would be the liberal voice for the B'nai B'rith, right?
Pretty much. Yeah. With a little CIA and Mossad.
For sure. But, you know, and Max Blumenthal goes to one of the world's most influential newspapers and writes this article, and pushing the official Obama administration State Department line on the Benghazi attacks, and it was caused by a film about, you know, that was defamatory of Islam, which was obviously not the reason the attacks happened. But he can go in there and he can write op-eds for The Guardian, and no one expects him to condemn The Guardian for anything The Guardian has said or done.
Let's go back to that op-ed, because that is profoundly dubious, because, you know, one thing that we do know is that the coincidence of this huge scandal of this non-film, the supposed film attacking Islam, and this big scandal that was engineered over this by people with vast amounts of money putting this out onto the internet and promoting it using these cyber promotional techniques, that whole scandal was designed to provide a sort of an excuse or a cover story for the attack on Benghazi. What that means is that the people who produced that film did so precisely in advance to provide cover for this attack on Benghazi, which had completely other motives. Absolutely. And therefore, somebody who is going and putting out disinformation in The Guardian about this, trying to support the ludicrous cover story, as Max Blumenthal did, this is very disturbing. And again, it makes you wonder about who Max is really working for.
Absolutely. And we've touched a little bit on his father's role in the destruction of Libya, but Sidney Blumenthal has been a long time aide and close friend of the Clinton family. In fact, he was one of the first people who discovered Bill Clinton in the late 80s. I was reading a little bit in his book, which was basically a long, apologetic defense of the Clinton administration, Clinton's wars from 2003. He's talking about how he was one of the first people on a national level to discover Bill Clinton when he was the governor of Arkansas speaking at this event. So, you know, Blumenthal's been connected to the Clinton family for close to 30 years. He's been one of their closest aides. There's evidence, I believe, a blogger called DC Dave was exposed to how Blumenthal helped promote and muddy the waters on the Vince Foster alleged suicide. And so, yeah, this is a man who for many, many years has been associated with this Clinton family and involved.
Probably someone called the Clinton crime family?
Yes, Clinton crime family. Indeed, I would certainly agree with that. Kind of like the Bush crime family, the Clinton crime family, two peas in a pod. But and with Sidney, though, it's funny, Rahm Emanuel, of all people, gave Sidney Blumenthal, another one who Max Blumenthal pays lip service to opposing, is Rahm Emanuel and his policies as mayor of Chicago and all that. But Rahm Emanuel referred to Sidney Blumenthal, gave him the nickname Grassy Knoll because of his penchant to push conspiracy theories about the Republican Party. So you can look at a lot of Sidney Blumenthal's early work. When he first made his name on a national level, he was actually one of the first people to name drop neoconservative and push it in like national publications like the Washington Post and the New York Times in the early to mid 80s when the Reagan administration was the neoconservative taking over the Republican Party in the Reagan administration. And you can look at Max Blumenthal's early work and you can see the early work that he did in the early part of the 2000s before he kind of got involved in the Palestinian cause. And it was all about this, it was all this partisan stuff about the Republicans and how the right-wing element of the Republican Party, you know, kind of what you maybe call the religious loony.
The vast right-wing conspiracy, in Hillary's immortal words.
Yes. Yeah. And how it was all focused on these religious Christian conservatives and how their backwards agenda is hurting the country. And so, I mean, there's very much a correlation between Sidney Blumenthal's work and how he got his rise to prominence and Max Blumenthal's. Although I think with Max Blumenthal, he's more or less, instead of playing like an open establishment operative that Sidney Blumenthal has over the years, Max Blumenthal is more or less doing it from a more covert status and infiltrating himself within these genuine grassroots movements for justice. Mm-hmm. And,
do you think, though, that I have some colleagues over at Veterans Today who have seeing both the Bush crime family and, to some extent, the Clinton crime family, as I would call them, close up, and are convinced that the Clinton crime family is less obnoxious and destructive than the Bush crime family? I mean, to me, you know, the lesser of two evils is still evil.
Absolutely, yeah.
But some of these people would argue that it's actually a very major step forward that somebody like Sidney Blumenthal and his son Max, these very well-connected players, are actually, they've moved so far away from the dominant Israeli agenda of Netanyahu and his Likudnik cronies, and are now at least giving some lip service to the rights of the Palestinians, that this is a positive thing overall. And this has even been pushed to the point that I've had this conversation with a couple of people at in and around Veterans Today who argue that Hillary may not be as bad as she looks, and the argument is that yeah, she's a closet sympathizer of the Blumenthals. No, now, you did mention, though, that she's on record like praising the work of Max Blumenthal in this email. Maybe you could mention that and how you would contextualize that.
Yeah, for sure. First of all, I would say that there's absolutely nothing good coming out of the Blumenthal's tilt towards the Palestinians. In fact, I see it as a negative because I see it as being more or less of a way to control the narrative and just further confuse people and further blurry the lines between what really is and is not going on. But on the topic of the Clinton emails, I believe Sidney had sent her a copy of his book, Republican Gomorrah, which is just this article, as you said, the vast right-wing conspiracy within the Republican Party and the Christian right, and she praised his work. And I believe also, and I need to double-check this because I don't want anything false getting out on this broadcast here, but I need to double check this, but there was also an element, I believe she sent him an email, Sid forwarded her the Guardian article I mentioned, and Hillary's response was, your Max is a mitzvah, basically praising him as being a gift. And this is in 2012 here. There was also a more recent episode with Max Blumenthal and Hillary Clinton when Elie Wiesel died just a month ago. And Max Blumenthal had said some very, would be considered inflammatory comments about him, saying that he was righteously saying that he was an apologist for mass murder, using his own people's experience of genocide to promote genocide of another people, being the Palestinian people. And there was a big brouhaha in the media where some media outlets picked up on it, and Hillary Clinton condemned Max Blumenthal for his comments. And I almost see that as being like a way that has to be questioned, whether or not it was a sincere denunciation of him, number one. It also makes you wonder if this is just a way to further continue to build Max Blumenthal's name within this progressive community as being this legitimate hero of the Palestine resistance. I wonder if that was orchestrated.
Yeah, you do have to wonder. I mean, I try to always, let people, I give them the benefit of the doubt until I know better. So with something like Max Blumenthal, when he does stuff that's obviously got a serious problem attached to it, like drawing these discursive red lines and saying Abby Martin's not guilty of trutherism, trutherism is an evil crime, that's a serious problem.
It is.
When he declares Alison Weir a bad person based on her going on a radio show, that's ludicrous.
When McKinney for not throwing the government line on Syria.
And Gilad Atzmon for questioning Jewish identity politics, which is where a lot of these problems grow out of. That's all very bad. And so we should definitely be aware of that. But I think we have to be a little bit careful and think very carefully about these other cases where, could it be that he is just a kind of a, he's coming psychologically. He's coming from a certain place, and he feels the need to push back a little bit and define his space. And say, well, I've violated these taboos here, and I can go so far as to go after Elie Wiesel, but I can't go so far as to accept 9/11 truth. In other words, there's an actual mentality in many of these people that very sort of their minds are constrained by social taboos and by the political atmosphere that they breathe. And it's hard sometimes to separate that from kind of cold, calculating, political operative kind of stuff, where, is he being paid to infiltrate and steer us in the wrong direction, or is he just the prisoner of a zeitgeist? And that's, I have no idea.
Well, that's a very good question, and I would not even, regardless of his motivations, I would not deny or doubt that there is some psychological, psychological, emotional attachment that he has to these issues that might keep him from going certain places. I don't doubt that. I think that might be the case with a lot of people that are involved in this operation. I certainly think for sure that's the case. But I also think that he knows that he has to at least deep down know that he's operating from at the very surface, a dishonest perspective. He's operating out of dishonesty. He's not operating out of honesty. I think he understands and realizes that. And when you look at his history, writing for Media Matters and writing for The Nation and some of these outlets. And, I mean, Sidney Blumenthal just as recently as this past year, it came out during the hearings of Congress, that Sidney Blumenthal just as recently as last year had received, I believe it was $200,000 from Media Matters. That just came out in Los Angeles Times last month. So I think that, yes, there probably is, I won't doubt that there is certain psychological reasons that he won't go certain places. But I also think that I'm just going to say deep down, I think it's complicity. I think he's coming out of a place of dishonesty. That's my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great book out by Martin Schatz. He's a psychiatrist, I believe, from Boston, and it's called "The History Will Not Absolve Us." Mm-hmm. And Marty Schatz wrote this a long time ago, looking at the left media response to the JFK assassination. And he pointed out that if you go back and actually follow the publications in The Nation and these other mm-hmm. left-wing kinds of places and look at how they responded to the JFK assassination and then this evidence that started coming out that mm-hmm. it was a coup d'etat
yeah.
and how they shrunk away from that evidence, even when it was presented to them very, very clearly and indisputably. Yeah. And he asked himself, well, why were they doing this? And of course, we do know now that there was this Operation Mockingbird CIA project that had infiltrated the media with 1,000-plus key people, owners, editors, mm-hmm. journalists. You know, the quote to Bernstein, Carl Bernstein's Rolling Stone article, was you could get a journalist cheaper than a high-end prostitute. You know, so there was that. There was the complicit, owned intelligence agency media that was hard at work. And then you had the CIA putting out mm-hmm. memos to their Operation Mockingbird assets and to everybody else that they could gain their ear, saying, we have to call these people conspiracy theorists. Yes. You know, let's attack the conspiracy. And that's where that term came out of. Before that, it had virtually no circulation. The CIA essentially gave us the term conspiracy theorist, and it was part of their program to denigrate anybody asking questions about the JFK assassination. That's so anyway, Marty Schatz is looking at this whole thing. And he tries to figure out, well, why were these left-wing thinkers and journalists that he basically, many of them he really admires, mm-hmm. Shying away from this grotesque murder yeah. of a basically decent head of state in a way that totally crushed the whole program that these left people supposedly support? Why won't they mm-hmm. rise up and say, you just killed our leader? You know, we need to start a revolution here. Sure. What's the problem? Well, the problem is, of course, that what he discovers is that some of these people almost admitted it, that they understood that they had a place at the table mm-hmm. and that you can have a place at the table and you can carp about Vietnam, you can carp about, you know, racial justice and segregation, yes. you can carp about, you know, socialism still and all of these things. Yeah, you can do all the carping you want at the table and you can still eat this big, exactly. fancy meal and collect a nice salary and hobnob with the power brokers and the movers and the shakers and, you know, fly around the world and be respected mm-hmm. and all of this kind of stuff. You can have that life. You can have your cake and eat it too. Absolutely. You can have your salary and criticize the empire and be the voice of conscience. You can have all of that as long as you don't cross these red lines. Because if you cross the red line about the mm-hmm. JFK assassination, you know, you've just lost your place at the table. And if enough of them do it, they just turned over the table. They just took that table and slammed it upside down. The table is Absolutely. Now gone. The truth about JFK knocks over the table. The truth about 9/11 yep. knocks over the table. The truth about the Zionist control of the United States from World War I, when the U.S. was dragged into World War I by the Zionists in order to create Israel down the line. The truth about World War II, well, let's not even go there into all the details, but let's just say that World War II was not the heroic allies versus the 100% evil demonic Nazis, is the way we've been told. You know, to any of these kinds of issues, precisely the ones that these gatekeepers are gatekeeping on, all these issues, turn over the table.
Absolutely.
That's the end. And, you know, you go to these places on Palestine, and that's the end of Israel. And I don't think Max Blumenthal or any of these people want to end Israel yeah. by having the American people rise up against this, you know, tribal group that took over their country in a really destructive, evil way and then murdered 3,000 Americans on 9/11. That's too much. That's too scary. It's even scary for me. And I'm not part of this tribe. I would love to see Israel fold tomorrow morning. I'm totally committed to the truth. But even I am I would have a little bit of trepidations, you know, if the full truth comes out and people are out in the streets with the torches and pitchforks.
Exactly.
Am I going to have to go defend my Jewish neighbor against a mob that's going to kill me on the way to get him, you know? So I can sort of see why these people have that. Maybe it's unconscious in many cases. I don't know.
Well,
what do you think?
It's funny. I think you mentioned JFK, and I haven't looked at all of, like, the documents looking back at how those establishment outlets covered it, but it seems very obvious that the response, especially these left-wing outlets, was very similar to how they responded to 9/11. Like, you know, you mentioned The Nation, how it responded to JFK. Of course, David Corn from The Nation was one of the first people to attack 9/11 Truth, by the way.
Yeah.
But going back to that, it's funny how they allow these establishment figures to shape the narrative. You know, like, there's nobody seriously questioning this 9/11 commission headed by this, you know, three-decade-long congressman from Indiana, Lee Hamilton, and this governor of New Jersey, Tom Keene, or this Zionist he is a Zionist. He actually admitted that the Iraq war is for Israel, Philip Zelikow.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people within the 9/11 truth movement who just say that, oh, his sole purpose was to protect Saudi Arabia, which is so obviously not true. To allow them to control and to shape this narrative, and they just unquestioningly accept their findings. It reminds me of something I saw recently within the Warren Commission. There was a man named John McCloy, who's a member of the Warren Commission. I watched a clip of him talking to Walter.
David Rockefeller's man.
Yes, absolutely. John McCloy was talking to Walter Cronkite about the Kennedy assassination. He talked about how he went down there and he was skeptical, and then his buddy Alan Dulles, he went down there with them to the depository, and they looked out and they held the weapons that Oswald allegedly used, and he came to the understanding that yes, it was a lone gunman, and
mm-hmm.
he had his mind shaped. But this guy was, I mean, he was simultaneously the head of the Ford Foundation, and I believe he was also the head of the Rockefeller Foundation at the same time. He might have also been the head of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, he was actually sent to Dallas to the meeting where they gave the nod to the assassination. He was there with
Nixon. I did not know that.
Yes,
part.
In Dallas the night before, on November 21st, 1963, there was a meeting. Richard Nixon was there. George Bush was there.
Well,
Lyndon Johnson was there. J. Edgar Hoover,
wow.
I believe, was there. And E. Howard Hunt, the oil baron, was there. Kennedy was trying to get rid of the depletion allowance. And McCloy was there. And that was the meeting where they gave the nod to whacking JFK.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnson's mistress was there, too. Yeah. She didn't attend the meeting. Johnson walks out of the meeting, you know, walks up to her and says, after tomorrow, we're not going to have to worry about those goddamn Kennedys anymore. I may be slightly mangling the quote, but that was the gist of it. And I actually just talked about this with William Pepper on my radio show a little bit back, and he pointed out that he knows David Rockefeller. He had some romantic involvement, apparently, I think, some kind of involvement with a Rockefeller daughter. And at one point he wanted to talk to David about this because he knew that David had sent John McCloy to that meeting where they gave the nod to whack JFK.
Wow,
and so Bill Pepper wanted to talk, you know, to basically give David Rockefeller a chance for a confession. But apparently the female Rockefeller that Bill Pepper knows was not really on board with confronting her father, I think it was, with that kind of shocking, you know,
sure.
It would be a shock to him. I mean, the guy's, what, 100 years old now? I mean, why is the world still being run by 100-year-olds?
Yeah,
I mean, Brzezinski, Kissinger, David Rockefeller, and these same people that have been running the world since the 1960s.
Kennedy's only in his 70s, but he survived when he should be dead, too. I mean,
yeah,
you know?
I thought his heart gave out a
right,
long
right,
time ago.
Yeah.
And
I, by the way, I'm glad I'm on here because I'm also getting a history lesson. I was not aware of all this information about McCloy and the member of the war.
I hope I got every detail right. I might have placed one wrong person at that meeting, but, you know, Allah forgive me if I did.
But with McCloy,
just true.
Being, and I did not know that about him, so it makes sense that he was hand-selected probably by executives at CBS, maybe by William Paley or somebody like that, to go on there and push the official narrative because he was directly involved in the plot. So, I mean, that makes sense to me now, and it doesn't surprise me, but even basically just his credentials, the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, Council on Foreign Relations, I believe he was overseeing the rebuilding of Germany after World War II as well. I mean, it all makes sense, and I can strongly sense it, just like with the 9/11 Commission. I can almost guarantee there's not one prominent progressive liberal that time period that seriously even brought to attention the fact that this guy's on the Warren Commission. He's directly lying to Walter Cronkite about this made-up story of having his mind changed by Alan Dulles regarding the magic, the single bullet theory, and how he
such a childish story.
Lone gunman.
It's such a childish story. Oh, you took me to the book depository.
Yeah, exactly.
I looked up and I said, oh, I can see, Oswald. I can visualize the lone gunman.
Yeah.
What bullshit.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
And, And as you said, it is, and I guess I don't have to worry about dropping four-letter words. It is bullshit, and it absolutely is. But to the point, it's amazing, and you have to ask these questions. Why there was nobody prominent at that time period who was asking these questions, who was like, why is this man on the Warren Commission? Why is this man giving these stories, and nobody's scrutinizing it? I bet very few people even know about this interview with Walter Cronkite that was done. And of course, the average American population, just like having a Paul Bremer whose hundreds of his employees died in the World Trade Center on 9/11, he goes on TV and says that it's Osama bin Laden that was responsible for 9/11. The morning of, he just happened, of course, not be at work that day. Americans are conditioned to take these people when they have these credentials next to their names, like a John McCloyne. They see all these organizations and all these esteemed institutions he's a part of, to take the name at face value. But even the people who would normally question this, like, I guarantee if most progressives knew of his credentials, they probably would inherently not trust a man like this. But they're being left out in the dark by the people that they're relying on for the truth about this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the reasons that this kind of behavior by people like Max Blumenthal and other left gatekeepers who are, whether innocently or not, preventing people from looking into really sensitive areas. They're not doing us a service, because what they're ultimately doing is propping up this whole house of cards of illusion.
Exactly.
And they're protecting these incredibly corrupt forces. And so, let's say, giving Max the benefit of the doubt, let's say he helps turn the discourse a little bit in a beneficial direction on Palestine. But if he has got, helped support this mentality of you can't talk about this, you can't talk about that, and prevented people from learning about these kinds of issues that would utterly destroy their faith in these establishment institutions.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's actually preserving not just those institutions, but the institutionalized corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the full truth about this stuff is so important. It's worth taking that chance. It's worth taking the chance on overturning the table, on utterly trashing people's faith in these institutions, and then, hoping that we can lead people in a good direction. I think that we would. I mean, I don't think that people are going to like burn down the country or go into these pogroms or anything if the truth on these matters comes out. I experienced the San Francisco Loma Prieta earthquake of 1989, and it was a pretty tough town. I lived in some pretty tough neighborhoods in San Francisco. Like, there was a murder on my block at least every 6 months for a while at one place in the Mission District. So you would think that the kind of looting that we saw in the Rodney King demonstration in San Francisco, I was there as people were smashing windows. I was very aware that there was a kind of a lawless edge in San Francisco. So imagine there's an earthquake that knocks out the power for 3 days. How are people going to respond? You kind of think, well, mass looting and craziness, right? No, it turned out that the whole city sort of came together. There was virtually, it's like the 3 days with the least crime in the history of San Francisco was when the power was out and the police and the authorities were too busy with other stuff. They never could have responded to any crime. It would have been a perfect time for criminals to go crazy, but they didn't, because this kind of shock to the system had left people like seeing things with new eyes. And I think that that would happen if we could get the truth out in a really big, shocking way and utterly annihilate the people's faith in these corrupt institutions.
Absolutely.
Kind of all at one big blow. Boom. These are the people who've been ruling you. They murdered your best leaders.
Uh-huh.
They murdered 3,000 Americans on 9/11. They're supporting genocide all over the world. A huge change has to be made. I think that we could trust the people to insist on a positive change and a reconstruction of institutions along lines that would actually greatly improve the world.
I agree with you absolutely, and I think that people inherently, they're not going to be violent in those situations, and this is another area where it's so influential for the establishment and those in power to have these moles and elements that are claiming to be opposed to the establishment working on their behalf, because you can also go in and you can infiltrate and have put in people who are deliberately violent to cause disruptions. That was what we saw in Occupy Wall Street, where a few people went out of line, probably provocateurs, got out of line and started acting out and started destroying property, which justified an entire police crackdown, like in Oakland, for example, which is actually where Abby Martin, who we were talking about earlier, kind of got herself on the map, was through her coverage of Occupy Oakland. But going to that, they throw these people into the establishment, and I think it's also very valuable and to claim that these movements are violent and that these people are bad. And I think that's also where this element of I think that, I don't want to get too off on a tangent, but this, where we get into this identity politics and where the left likes to push anyone who talks about these topics, likes to lump them in as being bigots and racists and anti-black or anti-Hispanic or whatnot. They like to lump all these people together. I think that they've had this, I don't know if it, I doubt it's even something that people consciously think about, but this idea that these, that if the people were, and it might be a genuine fear amongst the Max Blumenthal's of this world, that if the people, maybe you could say like white, you know, flyover country, middle America, were to discover the truth about something like 9/11, that they would react in a violent, racist hysteria. And I don't know if they actually believe that, but that's certainly the reaction that they would like the general population to believe that they would react. And, but ultimately, I do think that people would not respond in that manner. And you're in, when you do, it's either, maybe you get a few people who act emotionally, but also, for the most part, those people are probably going to be, as has been proven in the past with the WTO protests in Seattle and also with the more recent Occupy protests, that they probably are working on behalf of the elements that are trying to discredit these movements. So for the most part, I do think people would react in a peaceful and in a productive way, actually, if they were to learn the facts of the crimes of their society. And the real fear probably is that they would respond in just that way, and that, as you said, that house of cards would come tumbling down if people were armed with the knowledge of the truth.
And certain people would lose their power and privilege and position and their vast wealth, and that might be a major issue here too. You know, one of the reasons I think that any kind of real justice for Palestine is just off the table is because at some level, you know, okay, some of the Jewish Israelis could see, you know, the liberal ones anyway, could see admitting Palestinians into Israel as equal citizens, giving the ones who are already there full citizenship, bringing, letting some of the returnees return, et cetera, but if you let very many ethnic cleansing victims return to occupied Palestine and you turn it into a nation that's colorblind, you know, with an equal protection clause, Palestinians are now equal citizens, if you do that, then the problem is not so much as they consciously would tell you. The problem, oh, these evil, these Palestinians, if they, oh, they'll swamp us and they'll take over and they'll do terrible. Well, no, that's code. And the code is for we'll lose some of our wealth and power. You know, these Palestinians who come back, they're going to need some reparations and they're going to compete with us in our businesses. We won't have a privileged position. We won't be able to steal all their water for our swimming pools. We won't be able to build these big settlement blocks, comfortable, air-conditioned apartments in the middle of Palestinian land and steal all of their resources, steal their water, steal their agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. So what the real story here is that somebody is greatly profiting, making money and power off of this oppression. And they don't want to give it up. It's that simple, really.
Well, I mean,
and likewise here, if we blow up the powers that be with truth, they don't like that. And the main reason they don't like it is because the world that comes out of that, even though it may be, it won't be apocalyptic and stuff, but it'll be a world in which these bad actors can't keep accumulating gigantic fortunes by doing evil things. Yeah. And that they want to keep doing that.
And I mean, I think there's probably, and I don't want to make false accusations, as I said, but there's no doubt in my mind that, say, one of the leading financiers of the progressive left and all these movements and outlets and institutions that have gotten a lot of, that have a lot of influence, George Soros, I have no doubt in my mind that he's in some way, shape, or form is profiting from what's going on in Palestine, even though he's leading these civil society institutes, your Fox News types, like Bill O'Reilly the other night, wanted to push his, oh, he's anti-Israel and all this and that, when actually, in fact, he's acting as a person who is, actually is pro-Zionist, but he's controlling the discourse by paying people, the people who would be most opposed to the policies that are going on. So, yeah, for sure there's this fear of losing this status and losing this element. And also, maybe you can elaborate on this. I think I've heard Gilad Altman talk a little bit about this, but is it true that the original boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement manifesto, so to speak, had in there a right of return for Palestinians and also talked about 1948, but that was changed over time to taking out the right of return for Palestinians and also going to 1967 instead of 1948?
No, which group was this?
But believe the original BDS state.
BDS state.
And how it was watered down,
mainly
by Soros money.
I think that's true. Yeah, okay. There was some kind of scandal about that kind of watering
down. And that would be an example of like these progressive Zionists coming in and taking over the narrative from the actual people who have been displaced. And also I want to say that with the Max Blumenthal, one thing about him, though, that gives him a lot of credibility amongst these communities is the fact that they really don't they really don't hold back in criticizing the actual what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. They're actually very open about it. I mean, they don't hold back on the gruesome details of what is going on the ground in Palestine. So your Max Blumenthal's and your Electronic Intifadas and these outlets that are ultimately, at the end of the day, are controlling the discourse and steering the narrative away from really understanding what's the real reasons why it's happening, they don't hold back on the actual criminality going on the ground. And I think that needs to be emphasized as well. And that is what gives them a lot of credibility within the Palestinian community, is that they don't hold back. So therefore, a lot of these well-meaning Palestinian activists believe that they are on their side because they are giving the details, the real details of what's going on the ground. But they're also, through in a deeper way, are keeping the very same people from understanding the real roots of the oppression.
Yeah, it's been suggested that by people like Alan Zabrowski, another person who's way outside of Max Blumenthal's sphere of acceptable discourse,
right,
that, you know, let's face it, the American people don't really care enough about these atrocities against Palestinians to actually change the policy based on Max Blumenthal talking about it. And so, you know, Alan Zabrowski, of course, famously said that what the American people do care about is 9/11.
Exactly.
That is, if we learn that 9/11 was done by these Zionists, that we, you know, watch out or the U.S. might turn Israel into a glass parking lot. That was a direct quote from Alan Zabrowski, the former, the head of strategic studies at the U.S. Army War
himself
College.
A Jewish man.
Yeah, and he's of Jewish, although he says that he expresses his Jewish heritage through cuisine, not through politics.
Well, himself, at least born Jewish.
Yeah. And so I think that he's onto something important here, which is that we do have to really think about what the actual effects are of these approaches. And, you know, here's where Chomsky is so obviously wrong about 9/11. You know, he insists that 9/11 is just a very minor crime of empire, when in fact it gave about half of the American population PTSD, clinical PTSD, which led to a profound shift in American culture, society, policy, and so on and so forth. It was incredibly important, and yet he's denying it. Why? Why doesn't he want us to go down the 9/11 truth road? Well, that would have a very powerful and profound effect. So, you know, once again, over and over and over, we see that they're steering us towards these things that are really ineffectual. I mean, talking about Palestinian suffering, for all of it's important, we do it on False Flag Weekly News. I bring out the Electronic Intifada, and I'll bring out Max Blumenthal sometimes.
Sure, yeah.
But that's not what's really going to change the policy. No. What's going to change the policy is when the American people are told, not only have you guys, you know, murdered 50, 60 million people since World War II in these interventions, not only are you complicit in the genocide in Palestine, the murder of millions of Muslims based on this big lie of 9/11, but you've been led down these paths, you know, going back through the world wars, you know, millions of Americans dead. The American economy destroyed post 9/11 by these trillions of dollars wasted on this. Look at what's happened to these American soldiers. I've just been reading a book on the burn pits where huge numbers of American soldiers have been poisoned, many cases, you know, to death, or, you know, almost worse, long-term vegetative states or horrific suffering by they were chemically attacked, chemical weapons deployed by the U.S. military. Poisoned tens of thousands of American soldiers in Iraq, just like in Gulf War I, they were destroyed. You tell Americans about this, let's face it, Chomsky heatedly denied this in our email exchange, but the fact of the matter is that because people are wired to care about their own tribe, that's the stuff that's going to be politically powerful.
Yeah.
And that's what they won't let us talk about. We can't talk about the Zionist takeover of the United States. We can't talk about the suffering of the American people. And I think we should talk about all of it. We should be clear that the suffering of a Palestinian is just as important to you and me as the suffering of an American. But we need to really lead with the destruction of the United States as our message. And then people like Blumenthal, a lot of these people say, well, we're racist, and they'll try and find some way to taint us by association with racism.
Oh, for sure.
And you have to ask yourself, is he trying to stop us from being effective?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. And in your exchange with Chomsky, he kept bringing up all this. And you asked him a very good question, actually. And I believe you asked him why none of his – what effect has his activism really had on changing the – really – waking people up. And that's a great point, because I mean, for all the years that he's for all the noise he made about Vietnam, and by the way, I find it interesting that his big rise to fame in the intellectual movement was published in the very establishment-friendly New York Review of Books, The Conscience or the Responsibility of Intellectuals. That is interesting in itself. But in all the years that he's done all this activism talking about the crimes against Southeast Asian people and the crimes against the Palestinians and the crimes against Central America, and I'll give Chomsky credit for actually linking, connecting the dots and linking Mossad to the Central American wars in the 80s. That is the service that he's done. But, I mean, in all these years, what impact has he actually had, and how much – and what impact has his contributions had on the overall shaping of the minds of the people? And this is where they – this is where they appeal in some ways and have perfectly figured out this idea that conservative Americans are traditionally – they appeal to authority, and I think that they have latched onto this, and they understand this, that that Americans, unfortunately, it is an unfortunate thing, and I don't necessarily think it's because Americans are racist or bigoted people. It is unfortunate. It's in our DNA that we have been conditioned, especially since 9/11, to not emphasize with crimes done against other people. We either deny it, or if we find out about it, we find ways to justify it in our minds. I think that that's the way that our minds operate. But – and this is where they're wrong, and this is where a lot of, like, this is one of the flaws of, I think, a lot of Marxist-inspired rhetoric on the left, is that this idea that that Americans can't find out or that they don't need to know, and it's racist to care about your country as opposed to what's going on people globally, and they have instilled this false idea that people like you and me, we don't care about their plight because we want to try and focus on the Zionist role in 9/11 and the Zionist role, or even not even – it's not just Zionism. Let's make that clear. There are other elements. A lot of – all various elements that are involved in controlling and pushing these policies that have been destructive for so long. And they push this false narrative that people – that don't care, that we don't care about the plight of these people because – and when actually, matter of fact, I'd say that we probably care more than they do because we're focusing on the very events that are – that if people understood – would bring this all to an end. And while it is unfortunate that the average American really, and I hate to say this, doesn't care, unfortunately, about – they might not care, or it may not affect their thinking, the plights of the victims of depleted uranium in Iraq or the victims of the massive napalm bombing of North Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, unfortunately. They do care when Americans – are affected by it, when the your own government and the government of this foreign entity that we have had this 6 decades of conditioning to believe is like the that they are this chosen people of God narrative where they are our friends and our allies and they're beyond reproach because of their history of being persecuted. When Americans can understand that these are the entities that are committing the criminality against us that has led us to all these wars that have killed so many of our people, brought so many of our men and women in the military maimed and scarred for life, if not dead, when they understand that, they're going to rise up against it, and even though they may not really honestly care about what's going on in Palestine or what's going on in Iraq or what's going on in Syria that we've caused, it will stop because they'll stop supporting the policies that are leading to it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, if you push that logic to an extreme, you could end up with, let's vote for Donald Trump because as much as he has made racism respectable in mainstream, which is disgusting, he may be a better bet to stop this mass murder abroad.
Yeah.
So you know, there's even an argument that a kind of a racist discourse actually could go with a policy that would have good effects. Now, I'm not on board yet. Muslims for Trump was proposed to me a few days ago, and I'm not quite on board with that one. But I think we just have to live in the real world and try to be effective. I think people can empathize maybe if we can show people that, they'll kill Americans. They're killing Americans all over the place. Look at 9/11. And then they went and killed a lot of Iraqis. Maybe Americans will empathize with the Iraqis when they realize that we are the victims of the same group, the same oligarchical empire that slaughtered people over the world will slaughter us too. So rather than feeling like we're privileged and we're on their side, we should be rebelling against them. We should be fighting back against this empire just like the Iraqis were.
Well, it's funny you mentioned with Trump, and I'm not really a believer based on just what I'm looking at and the elements surrounding his campaign that he's going to bring about all this change. I really don't. But, I mean, one thing about Trump and Clinton is that with everything that people fear with Trump, as far as foreign policy especially, we know with Clinton. I mean, we know that Clinton is going to do the things that they're fearful that Trump might do.
Most of them.
Right, and Trump, even if he's sincere at all about his rhetoric about Russia and about NATO and even about seriously actually fighting ISIS in Syria instead of arming them, then that is going to – that would, even if his overall intentions are not good, that would be a monumental shift in our global policy as far as toning down these conflicts. If he is in the slightest bit serious about getting America out of NATO, or of what he says about, you know, making other countries pay for NATO, which would cause this major dispute, and U.S. leaving NATO as a result and lowering tensions with Russia and actually fighting ISIS, that would be a monumental difference. And I think lost in all of this rhetoric that is being overblown on the left, I believe by the George Soros and foundation-funded left, that they push this on purpose, regardless of the merits. And there are merits to this idea that Donald Trump is pushing this bigoted, racist rhetoric. But it's been way overblown. And being lost in all of this hysteria about Trump is the fact that if he is serious about some of these policies he's talking about, that it will change things, and it will make, I think in some ways, make the world a much less violent place.
Well, if we wake up and it's President Trump, the world will be a more interesting place.
Yes.
I hope
yes,
a better place.
Yeah.
But I don't have a whole lot of faith in any
no,
of these people at this
no.
point. I think we need to get the truth out so the
yeah.
people demand positive change. Well, thank you so much, Greg
oh,
McCarron.
One more thing, real quick.
Oh, yeah. We've got about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Left.
Make one real quick point about Trump. And you mentioned earlier the fear amongst the Americans of waking up and understanding, like, the patriotic element. That do want what's best for the country and that would wake up. I think there is a fear that even if Trump not himself is doing it, some of the people around Trump that could pick up on his message will bring attention to these crimes and will start to wake the sleeping giant up.
Okay, well, I hope it plays out that way. I'm still skeptical because there's some pretty dubious characters around Trump, as well as a few who look somewhat positive. But I guess we'll find out one way or another. So thank you so much, Greg McCarron. Yeah,
yes, sir.
Yeah, Greg McCarron, you blog at 9/11 Blogger. I really appreciate your piece of Blumenthal. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Take care.